This is The Takeaway for Friday the 13th of October, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I had no light. There was no electricity. And so I just started throwing things. I went into the garage with my iPhone light and grabbed a suitcase and just started throwing things into it.
Aruna Jayaraman lost her home and nearly everything in it in the Northern California wildfires this week. She and her two kids escaped just 90 minutes before the fire reached their house in Santa Rosa, while her husband Vivek tried desperately to get home from a work trip in San Diego. Their story is like that of so many north of the San Francisco Bay Area, where wildfires have been burning for nearly a week now and destroyed thousands of structures and claimed more than two dozen lives. I spoke to Vivek and Aruna told me that when the warning came in the pre-dawn hours of Monday morning, it was a rush to grab her kids and escape.
I ran up and I woke them up and they were just scared. And I kept telling them everything's going to be fine, but we need to evacuate. We need to get out. You know, they had their school uniforms out for that day. I grabbed those. I had my son get out of his pajamas and put on some track pants. And I just took my daughter in her pajamas and got them downstairs, and I thought, okay, at least in the car there'll be some light. And then I went to open up the garage door, and at this point, another one of my neighbors, my friends, had called to make sure I was evacuating, and I couldn't open up the garage door, and I'm freaking out at this point. I'm like, how do I get out? And you know, they're reminding me to pull the red tab and lift it up manually, and I lift it up, and then there's his basketball hoop. My son's basketball hoop is lying in the driveway, and I thought, oh, God, can I get out with that? And tried to push it up, and I couldn't. And then I was like, oh, okay, I can get around this. And so got around it, closed the garage door, and left.
Could you smell the smoke at this point?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. You know, once I went into the garage, you could smell it. And I couldn't smell it in the house. All the windows were closed. The winds had been howling the whole night, and they still were. And my son has asthma, too. And so he's telling me, you know, I'm having a hard time breathing. And it was horrible. Yeah, so it was windy and smoky, and the smell was really strong.
And then you got in the car, and where did you drive?
So, I'm on our street, and I called my friend because she had told me initially, you know, just get off the hill, go south. And so I called her, and she told me, don't take Bicentennial. Bicentennial's been closed off, to go on the back roads. And there's a small line of cars moving slowly. I called my other friend who had made sure I was getting out. And I was like, okay, like, where are you going? And she's like, we're just driving. We're just going south. And I was like, well, what about work today? And she's like, no, don't worry about work. She's like, they're evacuating the hospital. Yeah, so I said, okay, I should go to my sister's. And she's like, yeah, go to your sister's. My sister lives in the East Bay. So I called my sister, and I told her, and she said, yeah, you know, come. And so we just drove, and yeah, the kids in the car, and they were wide awake at this point. And my daughter was just so scared. She's like, our house is going to burn down. And my son's like, no, it's not flammable. It's not made out of wood. And so, you know, he's trying to calm her down, and they're thinking about things that they wish that they had taken. And we just drove, and we called my husband. He kept calling us from San Diego, and I didn't have my headphones or anything like that. I barely took anything. And then he told us that that Round Barn, which was right by our house, had burned down. And my son heard that because it was on speaker, and he just burst into tears because he knew how close that was to our house. And my daughter's like, but you said it's not flammable. And he couldn't even respond. I was like, everything's going to be fine. Everything is replaceable. We were out. We're safe. Everything's going to be fine. And then we made it to my sister's, and, you know, about an hour and a half later, as we're almost at my sister's house, the alarm company calls, and they're like, you know, fire alarm is going off. You've got multiple burglar alarms tripped. And so I'm guessing at that point that the house was in flames and the windows had probably burst, making all those alarms trip. And I'm just so thankful. I'm just so thankful for my neighbor.
Vivek, all this is going on with Aruna and your children. You're stuck in San Diego. Give me a sense of what you were doing at this point.
You know, it's, so if you think about the time, it's, you know, between 2 and 4 in the morning. And so I immediately got on the phone with United to try to figure out when I could fly back. I had originally flown out of the airport in Santa Rosa down to San Diego, but pretty quickly realized that the Santa Rosa airport likely wasn't going to be operational. And so called United, got onto as early a flight as I could. In the meantime, I was just online trying to get a sense for what was going on. And reports at that point were, you know, really spotty and intermittent. I mean, this is, you know, the worst possible time you can imagine something like this happening, right? It's a Sunday late night, Monday early morning. Everyone's in bed getting ready for the week. And as I'm learning more and getting a preliminary sense of the fact that this is, you know, very serious, my biggest concern was that the kids and Aruna got out of the house safely. I mean, once I knew they were on 101 and heading down to my sister-in-law's place, I mean, that was just a huge sense of relief. And then from there, it was just trying to gather information and understand what was going on. I mean, the entire time, we assume, okay, at some point, they'll just go back home. You can never imagine the type of devastation that, in fact, has occurred, right? And so once I knew they were heading down there to my sister-in-law's place, I felt relieved. And then I was just trying to get as much information as I could. And then, you know, I had a full day of meetings at this conference and just trying to pass those things off to other people. And, you know, so that when I got to the airport, I could just focus on getting up to the family.
Well, you learned, of course, that Aruna and the kids were safe at her sister's house. And I know that must have been an enormous relief to you, as bad as it was. Have you two had a chance to go back to your neighborhood in Santa Rosa? What does it look like?
We have. We went back on Tuesday afternoon.
The next day.
And I always try to be very careful about exaggerating or the analogies that I use, because sometimes I think people make these comparisons, you know, whether it's to like a war zone or something like that, and it seems somewhat, you know, inappropriate. But there's nothing I can say that can exaggerate the scale of destruction and devastation. I mean, it looked as if someone had bombed the neighborhood. I mean, just block after block was completely leveled. I mean, it's just the scale of the devastation and the destruction even though now we've seen it, we've been up there a couple of times this week just trying to figure out how best to move forward. And so we've seen it now a couple of times, just the area. But it's still hard to wrap your head around and to comprehend. It's just, it's unlike anything I've ever seen.
You know, it was going down there and seeing it, you know, our driveway was intact. And then you go in and then there are these pillars from our front porch that were up still, but the front door was just lying there. You know, the basketball hoop was partially melted and our patio furniture was still sitting in the same way, but all just charred and the cushions obviously just gone. And then in the driveway by that basketball hoop, the kids had been out on Sunday. It had been a beautiful day until the wind started. And they had been outside playing with sidewalk chalk, and their drawings were, like, all still there. It was just surreal, you know, ashes everywhere. And then, like, these drawings of hearts and, you know, drawing of a girl that my daughter had done. Just surreal.
What have your conversations with your kids been like since the fire swept your home away?
We just keep telling them that all that matters is that we're okay. And, you know, my daughter has handled it really well. I don't think she quite grasps what has happened. It's been really, really helpful that we've been at my sister's and they have their cousins there. And, you know, that's like their favorite place to go to begin with. So this is kind of like this awesome vacation to some degree. They're not going to school. They're just hanging out with their cousins. But my my son, like, just to give you an example, like he saw these caricatures that my cousin, my nephews had done recently. And he's like, oh, I have one, you know, like when I was a lot smaller and it's with this dinosaur. It's from San Diego. It's up on my wall. And then you could see his face as he registered that that wall is no longer there. And he just walked away and he came to me, just burst into tears. So there have been moments like that, that, like, you know, your heart just breaks because he doesn't realize, you know, as much as you tell him how lucky we are, he's only 10. But, you know, when I saw the house like that and I thought, like, God, what if it had been a little bit later? What if their rooms were in flames? Like, what if it could have been so much worse? And so no, I'm grateful we got out when we did, even if we lost all of it.
The fires haven't stopped. And so there are many like us who've lost everything and now are wrapping our heads around the fact that we need to start to rebuild and, you know, slowly deal with logistical things from, you know, canceling, getting a PO box to canceling, you know, basic services to the larger things like, you know, thinking about how we, if and how we rebuild and what that process is going to entail. But then we have several neighbors and friends who are, you know, under a constant stream of, you know, evacuation alerts and different levels of preparedness because as the winds shift, the fire shifts directions. And so it's by no means is this thing over. You know, almost 60 kids down that school have had their homes destroyed. So it's, I mean, people are coming together in ways both big and small through all of this tragedy. I mean, just the level of generosity. And I mean, it's just been in many ways very affirming in terms of just the, you know, the quality and kindness of the human spirit. We're, you know, a long ways from really having a full understanding of the physical and financial damage that has been done. You know, this is a process that's going to be measured not in days or weeks, but in years, not just for us on a micro level, but for, you know, big parts of Northern California on a more macro level.
Vivek, Aruna, you've been through so much in the last couple of days, and you joining us to tell your story in such detail and everything that you've been through means an awful lot. And I hope it does something for you as you look at rebuilding your lives.
Thank you. Yeah, and I appreciate the opportunity to share our story. And, you know, it's not ours alone. I mean, there are so many thousands of families that are going through something pretty horrendous. And so just, you know, getting the word out and hopefully people can help and we can get our communities back. I really appreciate the forum.
Aruna and Vivek Jayaraman from Santa Rosa, California. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Should I be confirmed, I will with the utmost strength and dedication work every day to protect and secure our homeland.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and that is Kirstjen Nielsen. She's President Trump's pick to head the Department of Homeland Security. The president formally announced yesterday that he wants Nielsen to replace John Kelly, who gave up the Homeland Security Secretary job to be White House Chief of Staff.
Kirstjen has my full faith and confidence, and she also has the complete confidence of the law enforcement officers, dedicated professionals, and senior leadership at the Department of Homeland Security.
Kirstjen Nielsen is currently Deputy Chief of Staff at the White House, but she isn't a household name across this country. Eliana Johnson is national politics reporter for Politico. Eliana, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Kirstjen Nielsen isn't well known to the general public, Eliana, but what do we know about her?
Well, she is a cybersecurity expert with a long career in homeland security, and she entered the Trump administration during the transition, serving as General John Kelly's Sherpa, guiding him through the confirmation process, and really earned his trust at that time, enough for him to tap her as his chief of staff when he was at the Department of Homeland Security, and then bring her over to the White House, where she has served as essentially chief of staff to the chief of staff. it was with Kelly's blessing that she is now being sent over to the Department of Homeland Security to run the entire place. She is the first woman to run the Department of Homeland Security, and she is the first person who has actually worked in the department to then go on to run the department.
So what does Nielsen bring to the table in terms of the big functions at DHS? And there are many. Let's say counterterrorism, national security.
You know, she has been praised for her management capability and competence, some of which have been in somewhat short supply during the Trump administration. And Kelly has really come to respect her extraordinary work ethic. There was a story that bounced around where she developed an illness where she had coughing fits such that she broke her ribs and came into work nonetheless during the transition. But she has a deep expertise in cybersecurity, and DHS is really an enormous office that requires really management capability. And I do think, as you mentioned, she isn't a household name, and the department or the administration was really having difficulty finding somebody to fill this job. And it's something unique to the Trump administration, I think, where A, they're having trouble finding people willing to do these jobs because many qualified people have seen the way that the president has treated some of his cabinet secretaries, like Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, where some qualified people have not wanted to serve. So we've gotten, and this isn't a comment on Kirsten's qualifications or her competence, but some of the better known people have not wanted to step up to these jobs.
The Department of Homeland Security runs a lot of immigration enforcement in addition to national security. ICE is just one of the agencies that it controls. Is Kirstjen Nielsen on board with President Trump's immigration policies, including rescinding DACA, including the travel ban and a border wall?
You know, Kirstjen hasn't been a principal, and unlike typical profile for a cabinet secretary like a military general or a congressman, we don't know all that much about her political views. She has only served as a number two to General Kelly at DHS and then at the White House, and so it remains to be seen how her views will emerge and whether she will push back on some of the Trump administration immigration proposals or march in lockstep with them.
You know, Homeland Security also controls FEMA, and we've watched over recent weeks as FEMA responds to hurricanes in Texas and Florida. And in the case of Puerto Rico, a lot of problems with coordination, delivering food and water to people there. Was the White House sensitive to the fact that they were trying to respond to these disasters with no one officially in charge at Homeland Security as the scrutiny increases?
It's been really 3 months since July, and I do think as the search dragged on, you know, Texas Congressman Michael McCaul was a front runner for the position, and he fell through. He didn't impress White House officials in early interviews, and I do think that there was a sense of urgency in the White House, particularly with not one and not two, but three hurricanes hitting the United States. They did start to feel a sense of urgency to get a leader at the Department of Homeland Security. It's a point where they were subject to obvious criticism for not having somebody in that job.
You know, Eliana Johnson, you mentioned it already, but they've had a hard time finding what I'll call famous top-tier people to fill this job because of the president's treatment of his cabinet members in public. Jeff Sessions, Rex Tillerson, you name them. Kirstjen Nielsen has to be acutely aware of what she may be stepping into in front of the whole country and the whole world, working for a boss like President Trump, who, if he is displeased, will try to discredit you in public.
I'm sure that she's aware of that. You know, on the one hand, the Trump administration really presents an extraordinary opportunity for younger and less seasoned people to step up into leadership positions. Kirstjen's a great example of that. She's only 45 years old and, as I mentioned, doesn't have the kind of typical experience or background of a cabinet secretary, but somebody who's been praised for her extraordinary competence and obviously has earned the trust of General Kelly, who has also been praised for his competence and his leadership capabilities. But on the other hand, we are getting people who are less well-known and less seasoned. So if she's not aware that this is a difficult administration to work in, I'd be shocked.
We're going to let you go, Eliana Johnson, but Kirstjen Nielsen will have to be approved by the Senate. What are senators saying? Is this a lock?
I do think that she's virtually guaranteed simply because of the need to have a leader there and her lack of a controversial record.
and it'll only take 50 votes to approve her anyway, which means if Republicans are on board and just a couple of Democrats, it is a lock. Eliana Johnson of Politico, Kirstjen Nielsen, President Trump's nominee to head Homeland Security. Eliana Johnson, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
Let's stay in Washington now, because now that Obamacare repeal has failed in Congress, the president is acting to weaken that law on his own. Thursday, President Trump announced two health care measures that could create big changes to the Affordable Care Act. One was aimed at federal agencies and how they create insurance products, but the second, potentially much more sweeping. The White House also announced plans to scrap cost-sharing subsidies. That's money under the Affordable Care Act designed to lower premiums and help low-income enrollees. Sarah Cliff, the senior policy correspondent at Vox, was here. I asked Sarah what this really means for people's insurance.
So we don't fully know exactly how this will shake out, but a few things are likely. I think one thing that is important to know is that the people getting these subsidies, they will still get that money. Insurance companies are required by law to make sure that they get that money. The thing is, insurance companies will have to essentially eat that loss themselves if they're not going getting refunded from the federal government. So a few things could happen. You could see some insurance companies pull out of the marketplaces at the last minute, say, I don't want to take this loss. I was expecting that money. Open enrollment hasn't started quite yet, so I'm out of Obamacare for next year. We haven't seen that happen yet, but it's certainly possible that might happen over the next few days. And you will also likely see some people who don't have subsidies, who don't have some kind of protection from big premium increases, facing some really significant price hikes next year. One of the things we've seen insurance companies doing is raising their premiums, as they've kind of expected Trump was going to end these subsidies. If you have, you know, some kind of financial help from the government, there's a whole other pot of money aside from these cost sharing reduction subsidies. If you have some of that pot of money, you're protected. But if you're someone who earns too much to qualify for that, you could be facing premium increases upwards of 40 or 50% next year.
But that's just a remarkable answer, Sarah Cliff. I mean, policy debates happen in Washington. The debate over repealing Obamacare is years old. I think we get that. But you're talking about real effects on patients, on families that have really nothing to do with this directly, while the president just seeks to undermine a law that's supposed to protect them.
Yeah, there really isn't much of an upside to this decision. The Congressional Budget Office estimates it'll cause about 1 million people to lose coverage. It actually costs the government money to end the subsidy program, which is a little bit weird. Essentially, what happens is you end these subsidies, which go to co-payments and deductibles. Insurance companies jack up their premiums because they're losing this source of funding. And then the subsidies that go toward those premiums, those skyrocket up. So CBO estimates it costs $194 billion over the next decade to end this subsidy program. So fewer people with insurance, higher costs for the government. There really isn't a winner here, unless, you know, it seems like what Trump likes about this policy move is undermining the Affordable Care Act, trying to undo the Obama legacy, and sees this as a way to kind of kickstart Republicans into doing something. Say, hey, this marketplace isn't going to be working very well. You need to pass that replacement plan you promised.
Sarah Cliff, senior policy correspondent at Vox. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
And Sarah Cliff will be with us again next week to talk about sky-high emergency room bills, like the story of the $629 Band-Aid. Sarah takes a look at all that and more in her new podcast called The Impact, and we'll hear all about it Monday on The Takeaway.
Good. Nice suit.
Nice suit.
That's a nice suit.
Nice suit, Gerald.
Nice suit, Thomas.
Nice suit you're wearing, Harry.
Nice suit.
Nice suit.
Nice suit.
Nice suit.
Nice suit.
Nice suit, man.
Nice suit.
Nice suit.
Nice suit.
It's a nice suit.
Thank you.
The nice suit you got on there.
That's what I said.
Rafer Guzman of The Takeaway and Newsday film critic. Are you wearing a suit?
I'm not. It's denim over here.
Oh, come on, this is formal Fridays when you stop by for movies with us. You gotta step up.
Sorry, Todd. I'm very casual. Very casual.
All right, we'll let you go casual for today. Rafer is here with the weekend's movies. We've got two films for this weekend for your viewing pleasure. The Foreigner, starring Jackie Chan. We're also going to talk about Professor Marston and The Wonder Women by director Angela Robinson. Rafer, this is a Jackie Chan film, The Foreigner, that you're going to talk about. We're going to listen to a clip here. This is a humble London businessman seeking justice when his teenage daughter gets killed in a terrorist bombing. Listen.
My sincere condolences. There's nothing I can do.
What if your wife and daughter were killed by a bomb?
I do everything in my power to get justice.
So, I've chosen you, Mr. Hennessy. You will tell me who killed my child.
Again, I don't know.
You will change your mind.
Now, Rafer, this sounds to me like it has a bit of a Taken, a Liam Neeson feel to it.
A little bit. And I was really looking forward to this film because I really love Jackie Chan, and I never felt that he's really had his big, serious, real Western blockbuster action film. He's done a lot of action comedies, he's done a lot of family films, but nothing like really in this kind of heavy hitter action genre. And this is Martin Campbell, the director of Casino Royale, is behind the camera here. So I was hoping for a lot. And that's Pierce Brosnan there, you can hear as deputy Irish minister who might or might not be involved in the bombing. So I had high hopes for this. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of Jackie Chan here. We get a little bit more about the Irish gangs and who's sleeping with who and this affair and that affair. And I don't really care about that. I want some more Jackie Chan in my Jackie Chan movie. And I felt that this just didn't really give it to me.
Is Jackie Chan still fighting? Is he still kicking?
You know, he is. I think he is over 60 at this point, and he does look pretty good. I mean, there's only so much he can do at this point. But again, you know, he can still do a little parkour. He can still do, those kind of great, graceful moves that he's known for. Again, if there had been more of that in this film, I think it would have fared a lot better.
All right. Well, you talked about too many affairs in The Foreigner. Our second film, Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, has affairs in it as well. This is about a polyamorous love story. Dr. William Moulton Marston, his wife and their mistress. Now, he is the creator of Wonder Woman.
That's right. He was a psychologist, and he had this kind of an unorthodox approach to life that involved a theory about submission and dominance. And he basically put that into the Wonder Woman comics, which I don't think many people know. And his inspiration for that figure were the two women in his life, his wife, played by Rebecca Hall, and their lover, played by Bella Heathcote. I should say Luke Evans plays Dr. Marston. So you do have this kind of interesting, odd power dynamic behind the creation of this comic book heroine.
Do people who love Wonder Woman, will they latch onto this, or is it more of a sort of a love story, a love thriller?
I mean, you're not going to see a lot of Wonder Woman herself in this, obviously, but it does sort of present this very unusual, especially for the time. We're talking about the late 1920s through the early 1940s. Very unusual love triangle for the time that was not looked well upon by society. And the film, I do think, treats them with a great deal of sensitivity and respect. I would have actually liked the film to get a little more loose and sweaty, I think, since you've had this kind of interesting sort of trio here. But it's very tasteful and, again, very respectful and sensitive movie, and a very strange backstory to Wonder Woman. By the way, they also helped invent the lie detector test.
Oh, well, lie detector. Rafer Guzman is not wearing a suit and tie today, but he wishes he could loosen it. Rafer, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy-and-print. Staples, it's pro time.
Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg is in Washington this week, meeting with lawmakers investigating how the Russian government worked to influence the 2016 presidential election.
Things happened on our platform in this election that should not have happened, especially, and very troubling, foreign interference in a democratic election.
Sandberg in D.C. on Thursday there. Things happened, she says. One of those things, according to investigators, thousands of targeted ads linked to Russian accounts designed to sow divisions among American voters and to influence their views in the run-up to 2016. Facebook has already agreed to turn over more than 3,000 ads bought by accounts linked to Russia. New York Times technology reporter Cecilia Kong has been following Sheryl Sandberg's meetings as congressional investigators peel back the layers on just how sophisticated Russian-linked accounts were in influencing the 2016 race.
The lawmakers who met with the top executives of Facebook want to know what the company actually knows in their own investigation, looking at what kind of activity took place around the election by fake accounts that were linked to Russia, as well as other activity that was used on the website to sow discord and to work in favor of one candidate over another. So they really want to know what the company knows with all the data that they have and they have protected and private within the company itself.
What do we know so far about how Russian-linked accounts used Facebook in the election?
We do know that there were hundreds of fake accounts that were used to buy ads, and a lot of these ads were used to promote very hot-button issues. Some of them were very racially charged, and they were used and put in front of different targeted to different users on Facebook and put in front of them to get them to think about different issues and, in some cases, to push them toward one candidate or another.
Now, what kind of system would take care of this type of meddling? I mean, you mentioned ads, Cecilia, but there's also regular content that might have been seeded into Facebook that wasn't necessarily in an ad format.
Absolutely right. And that kind of data is much broader, and potentially there's much more of that kind of data. They're trying to assure the public as well as lawmakers that they're putting more resources into vetting what kinds of ads can be purchased as well as what kind of content is on their site. So they plan to hire 4,000 people to manually review ad purchases around political ads.
Cecilia, is the public ever going to see examples of these ads that have gotten the attention of investigators?
They will, and they will after November 1st, which is when the biggest social media companies, Facebook and Twitter, as well as Google, will appear in two separate hearings on the House and on the Senate side, where these executives will testify about what they did and what they knew were on their sites that were related to the election and potential Russian meddling in the election.
Now, those media heads, in fact, I call them heads of media companies, they don't think of themselves as media companies, right? I mean, the heads of Google and Facebook and Twitter say they're just platforms and not media companies at all, and that's getting controversial.
Yeah, and in fact, in many ways, this is the core of the debate behind these companies. These social media companies are where most news and entertainment is disseminated and viewed. And now they're making editorial choices. They're making choices as to what crosses the line in terms of free speech and what doesn't. And so that's raised the question of whether these companies should be regulated more like media companies.
But what's at stake for Facebook here? I mean, it's clear that they want to keep their platform as open as possible. They don't want to have to pick and choose which ads they run. They just want to be a place for all comers and make the most money.
That's exactly right. They just want to make money off of advertising. The more that people use their site, the more people press those like buttons, the more that they can offer targeted advertising. So their incentive is to just get people to continue to enjoy Facebook and to not be suspicious of Facebook. So this is what is at stake. The other thing that's at stake is regulation. What they don't want is any sort of rules, because these companies are, by and large, not regulated at all in the United States. They want to not have to report to the government who's behind some of these political ads in a way that's mandated. They want to be able to volunteer the information they know on their own terms. And the biggest fear is any sort of rules related to privacy, for example. So that would really curb their ability to offer, as I said earlier, targeted profiles of users so that advertisers can make sure that their products get in front of the people who will purchase those products most likely.
Cecilia Kong, technology reporter for the New York Times. Thanks for being here.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
It's just so hard to wrap your arms around the fact that your child would do heroin.
She told me that day in the hospital, I'm not done using. And I was like, oh, hell yeah, you are.
It's not that OxyContin is particularly powerful. It's that pain is particularly confounding.
Every muscle and bone in your body hurts.
It's so important for the mental health and substance abuse issues to be treated together.
We continue our series now on the opioid crisis in America, and we turn to New Jersey. In 2016, overdoses of the synthetic opioid fentanyl killed nearly 900 people in New Jersey alone. And now, New Jersey is saying pharmaceutical companies are largely to blame. Last week, New Jersey filed a lawsuit against drug maker Insys Therapeutics, claiming the company unlawfully pushed its opioid fentanyl prescription to a broad population when it was only FDA approved for certain cancer patients.
It's a very powerful opioid that's been used to sort of ease cancer patients into death. It's used for what's called breakout pain, which is pain that when you're on a regular course of opioids that, you know, it just doesn't do the trick.
That's data reporter Stephen Sterling of NJ Advanced Media. And he says that in New Jersey, that's not the only way fentanyl was used.
In one case in Maplewood, New Jersey, a doctor lost their license after they began prescribing it for tonsillectomies, which is certainly you know, a far cry from something that you would expect the most powerful opioid on the market to be prescribed for, something you might associate, you know, the treatment more being ice cream instead.
Stephen Sterling's been reporting on New Jersey's huge number of opioid overdoses and exactly why the state is going after drug maker INSYS.
Well, according to a criminal probe into INSYS, it was running a sort of like a pay-to-play scheme where they would give doctors different kinds of payouts, you know, in the forms of speaker fees and stuff like that, specifically for how much of the drug they were prescribing. And they did that by, you know, encouraging doctors to prescribe it for an array of things, despite the fact that the FDA had approved it for this pretty niche use.
So in other words, companies aren't allowed to promote a drug beyond what the FDA says a drug is used for, right? And the allegation here is that they had a whole system to make this drug a lot more popular than it was supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, the allegation is that it wasn't, you know, based on any kind of medicine at all. They were specifically telling doctors that if you prescribe more of this drug for whatever, and, you know, encouraging various different possibilities for doing that, we will give you more cash in the form of, you know, speaker fees, which are meant to be, in most cases, you know, educational events where doctors will learn something. And the federal government alleges that this never even occurred.
I mean, is this just a New Jersey story, though, Stephen? Does this happen in other places?
We've seen a pattern of states around the country that are not only just suing INSYS, but other marketers of fentanyl in different forms and other pharmaceutical companies in general. You know, most notably, of course, would be Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin.
And Purdue Pharma paid a criminal fine at the time, a record, I believe, $630 million in 2007 for illegally promoting OxyContin. Is there a chance that INSYS is headed down a similar road here?
It's a much smaller company, to be sure. But, I mean, they've already reached settlements to this point of nearly $9 million with some of the states that have filed lawsuits against them. There are a couple more that are active now, including New Jersey. So it seems that, though perhaps on a bit of a smaller scale.
But is there evidence that executives there knew just how dangerous this drug was and that what they were doing could be extremely dangerous to the public?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're manufacturing a drug like this and it's been around for a while, you would certainly have to. And I think that, you know, what you're seeing in, you know, some of these attorney general's actions that are filing the civil litigation is just sort of, you know, almost exasperation that, you know, this is something that's been going on for so long. I mean, the crisis was turning to fentanyl as we started to see more money poured into the marketing of the drug for various different things. You know, and when it comes to a case like INSYS, which certainly appears to be, according to the allegations, you know, some of the most glaring examples of, you know, marketing a drug despite the known danger, it's almost, you know, comes off as how do you have the gall to do that given what we've been through and what we are seeing now in the general public with a drug like this?
Well, then how are prosecutors in the state of New Jersey connecting their allegations about what goes on between a drug company and doctors to the broader opioid crisis itself?
You know, in terms of doctors, it comes on, you know, a sort of case-by-case basis. New Jersey has a pretty robust prescription monitoring program, and they've, you know, that's allowed them to look at prescribing patterns sort of more distinctly, which is sort of where I think you end up with these lawsuits that are going on around the country. That's become a more common thing as well. You know, a lot of doctors in New Jersey, you know, we looked at fentanyl in particular recently, you know, have lost their licenses. You know, I mentioned the doctor prescribed fentanyl for, you know, tonsillectomies. You know, that is by no means the only case of that. We're seeing a lot of doctors losing their licenses that have gotten a lot of money, in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars, from drug companies, you know, marketing a specific drug, and then turn around and turn out to be some of the largest prescribers of said drug. Often cases, you know, when it comes to something like fentanyl, patients are unfortunately dying or suffering severe long-term injuries.
Well, Stephen, you mentioned there have been similar actions in other states. Are we likely to see lawsuits like this against INSYS spread across the country?
It would not shock me in the slightest. And I think we can probably expect to see similar actions against other companies. You know, Ohio recently filed a lawsuit against four different marketers of different types of fentanyl. In particular, not including INSYS, they also filed a suit against Purdue. all indications are from the Attorney General of New Jersey is this isn't the end of what they're doing in terms of civil litigation.
Stephen Sterling, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stephen Sterling, data reporter for NJ Advanced Media.
Hi, my name is Nancy. I'm calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I want to say it's not just about the drug companies. Somebody should look into any link between drugs and insurance companies, because it's insurance companies that say as long as you can get out of the hospital and on a pill that you don't even have to walk, you can get in a wheelchair and you can take a pill for the pain, then you can be dismissed from a hospital. And that is what helps people get addicted to these painkillers.
We want to keep hearing from you about the opioid crisis, your experiences, and what you want to see us cover in our ongoing coverage. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page. And if you missed it, we did a full hour coverage on the crisis last week. That's on our website at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photo directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at fracture.me. And LegalZoom.com, providing American business owners with legal advice through its network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillikin. Let's get some Friday music now here on The Takeaway. Brad and Andrew Barr have been playing in front of different crowds for nearly two decades. For the last 6 years, the Barr brothers have been known as the Barr Brothers, and they recently came around to hang out with us in our studios. The Barr Brothers are releasing their third album today. It's called Queens of the Breakers. Brad is the brother on guitar and vocals. Andrew's on drums, and they're joined by Sarah Paget, who plays harp. The band has played with My Morning Jacket, The War on Drugs, and lots of other bands as well. But the Barr Brothers' own sound doesn't fit most labels available in rock today.
It kind of can go any direction. Sometimes it's a very organic and grounded experience, and sometimes it's completely disorienting and swirling.
So floating journeys of effervescence that swirl around your head. Sounds like it could be a little hard to go from concept to recording. How do you do that? Do you improvise in the studio? Do you plan things out or just kind of let it swirl?
On this record, there was a lot of improvisation leading up to the completion of these tracks. These ones we approached a bit different, literally improvising for days on end at a little cabin in Quebec. That was it, really. We just wanted to see how everybody played together again after, you know, 7 or 8 years of playing together. It was kind of like, let's check back in with where we're at.
Well, the opening track on the new album is called Defibrillation. There's a story behind this track and how it came to be. Would you tell that?
That song began last Christmas.
Draw the line, draw it again, on the line to my closest friend.
And my poor mother fell and hit her head in the bathtub. I, you know, grabbed her. We went down to the hospital. We sat there for, it was like hours, you know, on Christmas Eve, and just kind of taking it in the fluorescent lights, and I heard these two, the two rooms next to us had two different heart monitors that were beeping, and the drummer in me, of course, sat there just counting out the polyrhythm, and it was like a perfect loop, and I couldn't believe these monitors were so in sync, but just kind of out of sync. Everything was fine in the end, and when I got back to Montreal, I went to my studio, and the first thing I did was sat down at the drums and played that rhythm the best I could remember it, and recorded it and sent it off to Brad. And then I think I went outside, came back to the studio, and Brad had already sent back a song that he wrote based on that rhythm. it was really nice. It had all these little moments to bounce off rhythmically. Heartbreaking, soul shaking, overwhelming, undertaking. Hit me once again. The idea of these monitors, these two people in separate rooms kind of connecting, you know, in that way.
I mean, do you rely on sounds, rhythms from your environment like that quite a bit? Do they come from the world around you more often than they come from just inside your head?
To me, on a really good day, I wake up and the sound of the street sweeping machine mixed with the birds and, you know, somebody doing their laundry outside does sound like music. It's like a way for me personally, I can kind of check in with myself. When the world does sound like music, I feel pretty good.
So when you guys are making your music, you're pretty well known for some of the non-traditional gadgety instruments you like to pick up. I saw one thing where you're playing a bicycle wheel.
Yeah, we like to find new sounds.
We have here in the studio, see this turtle that we have? I think it's called traditionally a kalimba. They call it a sansa. I think there we have our drum, our toy drum that just kind of leave in the studio here in CR4 at the Takeaway. I wonder if you guys might be willing to pick these up and give us, 30 seconds of impromptu music.
I thought maybe you were baiting us with these things.
See, guys, this is great. We've had that kalimba here in the studio, that drum, for years. I mean, guests come through, ambassadors, senators, authors, it doesn't matter. This is the first time anyone's picked up those things to play with them where you can really nod your head to it.
What, you mean John Kerry couldn't keep a groove on this thing?
Not even close.
Picking up instruments that you don't really know what they're going to sound like, when they sound fresh, for me, that's almost easier sometimes than like being creative on the instrument that I've played for, 35 years.
Sarah Paget, when you were learning the harp, mm-hmm. I thought that maybe you expected to be in the local symphony or something and not necessarily a rock star. But now you're kind of a rock star.
I don't know about that, but yeah, I found that... when I was in university with other young musicians, there was so much passion and enthusiasm for that music, for playing Mahler, for playing Beethoven. And when I got into a professional context, the work environment actually felt sterile. It felt like kind of showing up at work and plugging notes into the right place. So I didn't enjoy it. And I just found that a lot of my friends were making music that I found to be more curious and creative and exploratory. That was something that I really connected to with both Brad and Andrew right away, is that they both have a very open-minded musical spirit to the world around them. So that's something that I really admired.
Well, Brad, you have a track on the album called Compromat, which is a term that sort of entered into the American-Canadian lexicon in the last year. Compromat, is this a nod to politics? What was this?
It's something about the nature of the music. It was leaning towards what, Bob Dylan called finger-pointing songs.
Look at the sun, go behind the hill, and look at the country through a dollar bill.
And the title Compromat, I don't know, it sort of seemed like in the climate of consumerism today, nobody's hands are really clean. It's hard to live these days and consciously knowing that you could be, just through your consumerism, could be, hurting somebody far away, and you have to really, be aware of all this stuff. And I guess it was that notion that nobody is really totally innocent. Everybody's got compromising material working against them if you really examined it.
Brad Barr, Andrew Barr, and Sarah Paget are the Barr Brothers. Their new album is Queens of the Breakers. It's been great having you guys here.
Thank you, Todd.
Merci, thanks. Todd.
There's a lot more of my conversation with the Barr Brothers up at thetakeaway.org, including a video of that impromptu jam session from our studio that you heard just there. Miss any of the shows this week? Maybe you want to re-listen? Well, all of our segments live online at thetakeaway.org, and you can get our podcast, too. It's at iTunes or anywhere where you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening and for being with us this week. We appreciate it so much. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. See you on Monday.
The Takeaway is supported by AliveCor, working to make heart monitoring simple, continuous, and digital. AliveCor's cardia devices deliver EKGs and detect atrial fibrillation right from the user's fingertips from anywhere. More at AliveCor.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.